Dissonant Times is a grassroots media outlet local to the Willamette Valley that represents, empowers, entertains, and connects the people of Eugene and the surrounding areas through sharing local news, resources, perspectives, and talent. These are some of the featured stories for the month of March in 2026, both by regular columnists and guests, all members of the community. The stories you'll be hearing are Oregon Burning, by incarcerated Wildland firefighter Hakeem. Emergency Rooms in Crisis, Understanding the Corporate Infiltration into Peace Health, by Cypher. Report Back from Minneapolis Week of Action, Lessons in Resistance, by Ollie. Mutual Aid Classifieds, March 2026, by Dime Reed. Amber Fitz, Request for Continued Support, by Dime Reed. Love is a Challenge, What I've Learned in Community, by Strawberry Pancake Faye Nopolis, Dissonant Times Disabled Love columnist. And The Court That Left No Record, by Jackson. Oregon Burning, by Hakeem. Hakeem is a Wildland firefighter and father of four who is facing 6 years in prison for self-defense against a racially motivated attack, despite his aggressor admitting he started the fight. Support this defender of our forests. State of Oregon versus Brian Hakeem Simpson. This case is not just about one man. It is about the integrity of Oregon's justice system and what it means for everyone who lives here. I came to Oregon to give the ultimate service, to put my life on the line to protect the forest, people, and communities as a whole. I now sit incarcerated while my appeal moves slowly forward at a snail's pace. My case raises serious concerns about the fairness in courtrooms, what evidence is allowed, what is excluded, and whose humanity is fully seen. These are not abstract legal questions. They shape outcomes that affect real people, families, and futures across Oregon. When evidence of racial bias is excluded, when judicial bias risks the perception of prejudice, and when juries are left without full context, it doesn't just impact one defendant. It sets legal precedent. It signals to every Oregonian that the system can fail and that failure can reach anyone regardless of race, class, and/or gender identity. My story is not only about injustice. It is about resilience even while incarcerated. I continue to write, reflect, and speak with clarity and purpose. As a visionary, I have not allowed this moment to define me as a victim. Instead, I stand as a symbol of endurance and resilience in the face of adversity. Because this is what it means to hold on to dignity when the system attempted to strip it away. Those who have worked alongside me, who have already spoken out about the deeper issues surrounding this case, including a culture where racism and discrimination were present and tolerated. This context matters because it shows what has happened to me did not occur in isolation. In many ways, I have become an ember in the darkness. An ember does not look like much at first glance. Give it oxygen, truth, and collective action, it can ignite transformation. Through my writing and poetry, I am doing exactly that, keeping a spirit of resistance against oppression alive. The fire in my soul refuses to be extinguished. This case is a call to look closer, to ask the harder questions, to refuse complacency. If justice can falter here, it can falter anywhere. If one voice from behind prison walls, one ember in the darkness, can spark transformative change, then what can you achieve with the fire inside of you? All power to the people, for the people are power. By Hakeem Shahir. Needs: 1. Money donated for legal fees, commissary. 2. Books Shattered by Sea. 2. Books Shattered Sea by Joe Abercrombie Trilogy, Book 1 through 3, and or books about Sufism. 3. Letters, pictures to combat the isolation prison is designed for. 4. Spread the word about this case to media outlets and local politicians and state reps. 5. Write directly to the governor along for clemency in my case. 6. Sign the petition. Mailing address, Brian Simpson, that's BrianSimpson, number 2743390, Snake River Correctional Institution, 777 Stanton Boulevard, that's Stanton, Ontario, Oregon, 97914-8335. Again, that's Brian Simpson, number 2743390, Snake River Correctional Institution, 777 Stanton Boulevard, Ontario, Oregon, 97914-8335. And our second story, emergency rooms in crisis, understanding the corporate infiltration into Peace Health by Cypher. By now, many have heard that Peace Health is not renewing its contract with the Eugene Emergency Physicians, who make up the staff of ERs in three Lane County hospitals, including Riverbend. More difficult to parse out is why and how this is happening, and what defenses are available to the community. This requires a deeper look at corporations' profit incentives to leech off of healthcare systems, and a critical eye to understand exactly who will be losing the most in what is scheduled to be a major disturbance to the entire fabric of Willamette Valley's emergency medicine on July 1st. What's happening? Over the last few decades, corporations have increasingly edged their way into profiting off of the sick and dying through contract management groups, CMGs, and management service organizations, MSOs, third-party companies that handle emergency rooms 24/7 staffing, billing services, and business administration for a cut of the profits. Currently, more than half of all emergency physicians in the U.S. are employed by these third-party companies, and many physicians report when these management groups signed contracts with hospitals that employ them, they lost autonomy and patient care declined. By design, these models introduce new greedy recipients of profit, CEOs, administrative staff, stockholders, without introducing new sources of revenue, which motivates them to cut costs, reduce physician pay, and pressure ERs to be more efficient, often sacrificing quality of patient care, in order to cut their own paychecks. For the past 35 years, Peace Health has staffed the only Level 2 trauma center between Portland and Roseburg, Riverbend Hospital, by contracting with Eugene Emergency Physicians, or EEP, a small physician-owned and self-managed group of local doctors. With EEP holding the contract, our physicians make their own informed decisions about our community's health care, and they don't have to cater to external interests that inevitably result in the trends described above. Without explanation or warning, on February 3rd, Peace Health Chief Hospital Executive Jim McGovern announced he will not renew the contract with EEP when it ends on July 1st, and instead will replace it with a contract with an Atlanta-based MSO, Apollo MD. Due to the 2023 closure of University District Hospital, combined with Eugene Springfield's aging population, Riverbend's patient numbers are at a record high, and ER wait times have been steadily increasing. But it seems only Jim McGovern and the corporate stakeholders who will profit off of this decision think a partnership with Apollo MD is the appropriate solution. Peace Health executives have insisted Apollo MD is not a private equity firm, despite records that show it was backed by private equity interest Valor Bridge up until 1 year ago. Although Apollo MD has obscured its financial profile, the available public record reveals a clear trend of cutting corners whenever possible to improve profits, to the detriment of its employees and patients. In 2016, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission sued Apollo MD for the discriminatory firing of a doctor due to his disability. Shortly after, one doctor that had worked for Apollo MD for 8 years brought a lawsuit against them for a Medicare fraud, accusing them of a pattern of intentionally misrepresenting the care patients had received in order to bill their insurance for more. a judge substantiated these claims in 2021 by denying ApolloMD's motion to dismiss. ApolloMD's obsession with cutting costs has also drawn in AI technology ventures vying to profit off the sick and dying too. On its website, ApolloMD brags that its recent partnership with Clio Health is, quote, one of the largest deployments of AI-powered clinical documentation technology in emergency medicine. Yet Clio Health's short track record reveals its own predatory nature, most notably through a court-ordered $17 million payout to consumers who proved in federal court that Clio Health was, quote, preying on the poor people that needed a helping hand. Will ApolloMD really be able to do this? ApolloMD's entry into the community of Eugene Springfield is the perfect test for Oregon Law SB 951, a law passed last year in order to prevent this exact kind of sudden corporate takeover. The president of the American Academy of Emergency Medicine, Robert Froelichstein, called on Oregon state officials to evaluate the contract with ApolloMD in the context of SB 951, explaining how the law was designed to, quote, prohibit ownership of a medical practice by physicians with a significant stake in the management service organizations, MSOs. Meanwhile, ApolloMD has been emphasizing its image as a physician-owned company, operating under CEO Yogan Patel, who is a graduate of U of O and has a license to practice in Oregon, along with 10 other states. ApolloMD went so far as to create a new local corporation, Lane Emergency Physicians LLC, in order to feign compliance with these Oregon state laws that protect against outside corporations pushing out physician-run medicine. ApolloMD established this LLC the same day the contract with ApolloMD was announced, arguing that this LLC, with an Atlanta-based physician as the sole owner, would serve as primary decision-maker on clinical matters, with ApolloMD simply offering administrative support. Former Oregon Representative Marty Weil explains this structure is, quote, commonly used in the industry to give a management company, like ApolloMD, effective operational control while maintaining the appearance of physician ownership. Governor Tina Kotek has asked PeaceHealth and ApolloMD to delay the proposed transition by 6 months, and a group of other Oregon representatives published a letter asking PeaceHealth to submit the transition for review for compliance with SB 951. The local government's response to ApolloMD's intrusion in our community follows PeaceHealth medical staff's prompt and coordinated resistance. In just a few weeks following McGovern's announcement, 93% of PeaceHealth medical staff voted no confidence in PeaceHealth executive leadership and supported restoring the contract with EEP. On the same day, all 41 of the physicians and physician assistants of Eugene Emergency Physicians signed a pledge not to work for ApolloMD for 90 days. Various medical staff at the Riverbend ER report that physicians and nurses have tried proposing their own innovative solutions to the ER overwhelm crisis to PeaceHealth management. Again and again, physicians have been dismissed or ignored. This decision to contract with ApolloMD without any forewarning or opportunity to challenge that decision is the final straw for most doctors. ApolloMD recruiters began calling the doctors working in the Riverbend ER to offer them the jobs they currently hold with contracts for $50 an hour less than their current wages, but none of them have accepted an offer. Many are already finding other jobs, making it unlikely Riverbend ER will have any of its experienced physicians at any point in this transition. What is PeaceHealth's incentive? In the face of doctors, nurses, community members, representatives, and the governor all begging him to reconsider, Jim McGovern has refused to change his mind and failed to produce any reason for replacing EEP other than a vague gesture to ApolloMD having, quote, more resources. Although PeaceHealth's decision to contract with ApolloMD is a new, distinctly horrifying level of misalignment with our community needs, it has been foreshadowed by many profit-motivated decisions by PeaceHealth in the last handful of years. At the end of 2023, when Peace Health shut down University District, Eugene's only hospital, its defense was that it just couldn't make enough money with a patient population that was too poor and too uninsured. Peace Health Management told its staff at the Riverbend patient that the Riverbend patient load would increase 15 to 20% following the closure. In reality, nurses report it's been a 30 to 40% increase in patients. Nurses explained that the surge in patients, especially in the wake of the provider crisis following the early years of the COVID pandemic, resulted in two primary factors responsible for the declining Riverbend ER: shortage of beds and a shortage of staff. Nurses report the provider-to-patient ratio is most often 4-to-1, even though, due to recent Oregon laws that protect healthcare workers and patients, the ratio should be half as much for patients who need more intensive care. The 57 ER beds are almost always full, and it has become normalized to have 12 to 16 hall beds full of patients. This hallway bed setup is precarious. There aren't enough monitors for the hallway, so these patients can't be synced up with the central system. So unless a nurse is standing right next to a patient, they won't know whose condition is worsening and who needs immediate care. Despite this dangerous setup, McGovern has insisted the use of hallway beds can be depended on as a typical use of space and resources. As if this wasn't enough, McGovern's policies have also mandated the automatic receival of all cardio and stroke patient transfers from surrounding facilities, regardless of Riverbend's ability to bed them. There's no contingency plan, no option for Riverbend staff to refuse these transfers, even if accepting them into the already overwhelmed ER may pull nurses and resources away from other critical patients needing care. Instead of an influx of beds and staff, which would address the true root cause in this crisis, Riverbend nurses have witnessed an escalating trend of cost-cutting measures that continue to compromise their quality of employment and patient care. Within the last 6 months, Peace Health has laid off 3% of its staff, including all overnight social workers and crisis workers, and all distribution staff who managed and stocked equipment. Riverbend admin has put increasing pressure on doctors to go faster and to see more patients, somehow twisting the culpability of a failing, commodified healthcare system onto the shoulders of the only people who directly provide the humanistic care. This is profit-driven medicine at its most dangerous. One experienced nurse explains, quote, "Kindness, compassion, and time to connect with a patient could be the difference between life and death." How will this affect the community? Many ER nurses are on the path to retirement or finding another job before all hell breaks loose in this transition. One nurse tells us to expect the ER to start hemorrhaging nurses. When questioned about a plan to retain nurses in the ensuing chaos that his decision has caused, McGovern didn't have a response. But truly, the ER nurses are the only thing standing between us and total chaos. The emergency room requires a high level of collaboration and trust among doctors and nurses. Of course, it's not perfect, but, quote, "it's a well-oiled machine," one nurse explains. It has taken decades to build up this kind of experience and cohesion in this high-paced environment. Furthermore, emergency rooms are embedded in an ecosystem much broader than themselves. EMS, cahoots, shelters, and social service providers, memory care facilities, and more. Good patient care depends on knowledge of and relationships with local resources. Ignorance of these will impede this new wave of doctors' ability to transition care and support of their patients outside the ER. Just 3 months before this massive transition, McGovern has not shared any plans with the ER staff as to how it is supposed to take place. Scheduled for July, one of the busiest months of the year, this transition will undoubtedly increase the staff's workload and ER wait times. Experienced nurses who are preparing to remain through this transition fear the higher risk of injuries and mistakes given the impossible pace and lack of resources, which they will likely be blamed for, and patients will likely suffer for. What can we do? The nurses who will be shouldering this transition encourage all community members to use their voices to speak out against Peace Health's contract change and to keep the spotlight on these injustices. They ask the public to continue writing letters to representatives at state and national levels and email Jim McGovern. Sign this petition, circulated by the Oregon Nurses Association, ONA, link included, and follow the ONA Nurses at Riverbend on Instagram for continued ways to support them. That's www.instagram.com/sacredheartnurses. Have confidence in the doctors and nurses of the Riverbend ER. In the coming months, compassion and a little understanding for the hell that our nurses are about to endure will go a long way. While mismanagement and a lack of institutional support are usually driving causes of provider burnout, patients who fail to show their caretakers patience and humanity can also take a huge hit to morale. More than ever, our nurses need to know that we see them, we want them there, and we want them to have the support they need to succeed. Nurses and doctors say they are seeing their colleagues continue to give the best care they can in spite of the policies and politics that are handed down to them. If nursing is anything, it is overcoming obstacles. We are good at what we do, and we love each other and what we do. And our third story, report back from Minneapolis Week of Action, Lessons in Resistance by Ollie. Minneapolis organizers started planning the February 25th through March 1st week of action, Bring the Heat, Melt the Ice, just a few weeks before it began. They put the call for out-of-towners and locals alike to come learn together and help keep up momentum beyond the end of Operation Metro Surge. On February 12th, Homan had announced the drawdown reduction in ice presence, but there were still thousands of agents in the city. We'd heard from Minneapolis friends how bad things were, how everyone was exhausted, heartbroken, and traumatized. We'd also heard how people continued to show up by the thousands, confronting ICE agents in the streets and building vast networks of mutual aid. We wanted to be there to support and learn, so a couple friends and I loaded up from Portland and made the drive. Bring the heat, melt the ice. The week of action brought hundreds of people to dozens of political education sessions, trainings, and actions. See, build it and they will come. A report back from organizers about their intentions behind the week of action for a more detailed play-by-play and an honest reflection on the ways in which it fell short. I was so grateful for what I learned during the week, particularly from in-depth trainings on patrolling, scouting for ICE agents by car, bike, or on foot, and rapid response communication systems. There were also trainings and discussions on tenant, school, and workplace organizing, rides coordination and mutual aid, block parties, wide awakes, how to intervene where ICE sleeps, how to care for public memorials after state violence, and more. Local organizer Ricardo Levins Morales led a session providing historical grounding for this moment, where he paid homage to the legacy of revolutionary struggle in Minneapolis during the George Floyd uprising, the American Indian Movement, in Cop Watch and police abolition work, and in the organizing work of farm worker, labor, and immigrant communities. Another focus of the week was to plug out-of-towners into rapid response networks. Over a dozen neighborhood groups created infrastructure for welcoming us on car, patrol, commuter, ride-alongs, and walking patrols. A big question on our minds was how to translate our learnings from Minneapolis to fit back home, and a panel of organizers from the Bay, Chicago, and Northfield, Minnesota, offered some ideas. Compared to Minneapolis, ICE activity in their cities, like in Oregon, has been more spread out. So organizers found it critical to map out regional ICE infrastructure, staging, and hotspots of activity, as well as to maintain region-wide communication. In Chicago, mapping led people to establish community defense hubs, or centros, where they could deter ICE proactively. In the Bay, comrades scouting for ICE in a neighboring county let them know ahead of time that CBP agents were going to stage at Coast Guard Island in Alameda. Having relationships and scouting across a broader region meant that they were better prepared to show up at Coast Guard Island and shut it down. Actions during the week included a worker march against ICE collaborators that drew attention to secondary targets and a No Collaboration, Free Our Neighbors march at the Sherburne County Jail, which has partnered with ICE to imprison people they kidnap. There was also a neighborhood block party day and a daily phone banking for the Twin Cities tenant union rent strike. The week ended with a march on Whipple, the federal building where ICE stages from and holds people. The action stopped ICE from going in and out of the building for a few hours, and 40 people were arrested. A common message from Minneapolis comrades was essentially, "Learn from our successes and our mistakes, but don't copy and paste. Study and adapt to your local context." So to start, what can we learn? The block. During the height of the surge, thousands of people were in the streets every day. People were interconnected and active on such a scale that their response time to ICE activity was under 2 minutes. How did they do it? Before the start of Operation Metro Surge last December, Minneapolis had set up a relatively centralized system where people would report ICE sightings to a hotline. Then the hotline would share that information with a loose network of responders. When the surge began, ICE switched from large-scale raids to snatch and grabs that would just take a few minutes. The centralized system was simply too slow and rigid, so people adapted. They created large signal chats to coordinate neighborhood-level community defense. Then those chats splintered off into smaller and smaller areas, down to the scale of a single city block. More groups formed around protecting schools, places of worship, cultural centers, businesses, and other places ICE is targeting. Autonomous, hyperlocal, decentralized groups sprung up all over the city around mutual aid and community defense. Every group has its own systems and agreements unique to the people who live there. When there is such a wide variety of organizing structures, and when there is no apparent leader, the movement is, as a whole, is harder to infiltrate or repress. Organizing with the people immediately around you allows for more trust building, a particularly vital component for coordinating mutual aid. Valuing a diversity of tactics allows people to remain nimble, move proactively, and effectively escalate. In the face of such overwhelming fascist violence, it can be hard to imagine what it looks like to build collective power on the scale we need. What I saw in Minneapolis reminded me that there is no singular way forward, no one leader, no vanguard coming to save us. All we have is our relationships, our courage, and our sense of responsibility to take care of each other. The neighborhood. On the scale of neighborhoods and across the city, hyperlocal groups are working together while still practicing their autonomy and a diversity of tactics. While there is no central leadership, there are strong systems of communication, largely relying on dispatchers, a focus on data collection and collective learning, and, of course, thousands of whistles. The dispatchers facilitate daily signal calls for patrollers in their neighborhood. Throughout Operation Metro Surge, a dedicated team trained and vetted over 1,000 dispatchers, building off of what they learned from comrades in Chicago. Relay information between patrollers and other signal chats to quickly share reports on ICE sightings using CSALUTER, a variation of the SALUTE acronym, where the C stands for Concerned Community and the R stands for Response Requested. They provide behind-the-scene support to patrollers, helping with road navigation, plate checks, checking a database of verified ICE license plates, and coordination, advising patrollers on where it would be helpful to have more coverage. They share information in a relay chat with other dispatchers to coordinate patrol handoffs between different neighborhoods. They act as a grounding presence, helping patrollers discern for themselves what to do and check in with them after intense situations to coordinate aftercare. And the dispatchers don't call the shots. Of course, some people end up trying to police or control each other, but the goal is for dispatchers to share information and guidance without telling them what to do. The data team. aggregates, analyzes, and distributes citywide data on ICE activity, helping reveal patterns in agents' behavior so that people can make informed decisions and stay one step ahead. Sources data and quickly shares it back to the community, fostering a culture of collective learning, and keeps track of ICE agents' behavior when they break the law and when they're collaborating with cops to support legal cases and help free people ICE has kidnapped. The whistles. The concept of using whistles for ICE Watch was another gift from Chicago. In Minneapolis, thousands of people are using whistles to stay loud, form a crowd, intimidate agents, and stop abductions. Whistles are a simple, effective tool to gain power in numbers, deepen community belonging, and inspire courageous action. The culture. By fostering a culture of openness, trust building, and collective learning, mutual aid and rapid response networks have been able to scale up quickly and continually adapt. Some key elements of the culture. Being welcoming and strategic about vetting practices. Hyperlocal and neighborhood groups tend to be very open to new people. One neighborhood has over 4,000 people in Signal chats, although some use systems to vet and onboard, especially among those doing mutual aid, ride-sharing, and dispatching. People are generally focused on growing numbers and building trust. Knowing your neighbors. Minneapolis has a history of neighborhood-level organizing, but people's local connections grew rapidly during Operation Metro Surge. Knowing your neighbors helps with coordinating mutual aid, responding quickly to ICE activity, and staying alert, such as when agents try to blend in. Having frequent in-person gatherings and trainings. Throughout the surge, people gathered to share resources, crowdsource information, and learn together. They organized dance parties, blockades, autonomous zones, vigils, and more to collectively express grief, anger, and joy while building trust and community. Navigating conflict, talking about mental health, and not tolerating bad behavior. Conflict mediators, mental health, and aftercare teams play a critical role, as well as many who share the load of keeping an eye out for infiltrators and addressing harm. None of this is to say that people in Minneapolis have it all figured out, or that they have created something perfect or free from the culture of capitalism, colonialism, and white supremacy. But many are putting in the work to grow a culture of collective care, to make mistakes together, and to respond at the scale the crisis requires. Folks in Minneapolis are giving us plenty to learn from, critique, and adapt as we continue to face the horrors of this moment, and I am deeply grateful for their dedication to passing on the lessons. The drawdown and what comes next. One of the main things we heard again and again is that the drawdown is a misnomer, a messaging tactic designed to outmaneuver the resistance. For context, the end of Metro Surge came just days after Alex Preti's murder, coinciding with Bovino, most likely, being fired as head of ICE coordination in Minneapolis, and Holman stepping in. Holman has been switching out the self-described turn-and-burn tactics Bovino used in Los Angeles, Chicago, and Minneapolis for a strategy that is just as cruel, but with different optics, relying more on secrecy and institutional cooperation, such as from local jails. The surge brought thousands of federal agents to the Twin Cities, at times upwards of 4,000, who operated at a scale and magnitude unlike anywhere in the country. ICE agents kidnapped thousands of people, snatching black and brown people off the street, shooting Julio Sosa Salas and murdering Rene Good and Alex Preti in broad daylight, and using every intimidation tactic in the playbook. While they're operating somewhat more undercover now and partially moving outward to the suburbs, there are still around 2,000 agents in the region. They are continuing to act as a blatantly racist occupying force. They are continuing this country's legacy of slave catchers, now with fancy tech, surveillance, and the bloated 21st century apparatus of the prison, police, and military-industrial complex at their backs. Many took the end of Metro Surge as a win, as a testament to the power they'd built together. At the same time, many I talked to were worried about ICE Watch and mutual aid networks losing momentum and getting less national support. and people's friends, family, and neighbors are still being held in cages. The kidnapping hasn't stopped. While numbers are shifting with a drawdown, the networks and connections folks have built remain strong. People remain determined to watch each other's backs. Many are focused on building out labor organizing and eviction defense work, expanding networks of care beyond this moment, and tactics like filing habeas corpus petitions to get people out of deportation holdings. I have no idea what's going to happen next in Minneapolis, but I feel that something has fundamentally shifted in the political landscape there, and I doubt there's any going back. On the digital version of this story on Dissonant Times website, there is a list of resources for more reading on some of the themes touched on. Our next story is Mutual Aid Classifieds, March 2026. The Mutual Aid Classifieds is a compilation of support opportunities from local groups that provide material aid and support locally. Read about how people are taking care of each other and how you could participate. What is mutual aid? Mutual aid is, simply put, neighbors taking care of neighbors, founded on the principle that we take care of us. Those best positioned to support one another are usually the ones close by. We exchange resources and services for collective benefit to overcome social, economic, and political barriers to meeting our most essential needs. Mutual aid can include physical resources like food, clothing, or medicine, as well as emotional and mental health care or skills and education. By taking responsibility for caring for one another, we all become safer and happier, changing political conditions through interreliance. Here are the descriptions of the organizations, how to get involved, and the ways they could use more support. Washington Jefferson Food Squad, WJ Food Squad. This group serves a potluck buffet at the West Washington Jefferson Park basketball courts every other Sunday, 5 p.m., until they run out of food or everyone has eaten. Always done by 7 p.m. Ways to support? Volunteer to set up, break down, and or bring hot food, to-go sandwiches, snacks, drinks, non-alcoholic, cash donations, blankets or sleeping bags, first aid and hygiene supplies, tarps. For more info or to get involved, email redtwig@protonmail.com. That's redtwig@protonmail.com. Next, we have Get Out of Jail Support. This group provides supplies and other support to those being released from the county jail. They try to be out there Fridays from 2 to 5 p.m. and Mondays 2 to 5 p.m., but it depends on who's available. They could use in-kind donations of snacks, cigarettes, hygiene supplies, bags or backpacks, and bottled water. Clothes and socks welcome. Email Dissonant Times to get connected. Free School Eugene, a group coordinating free classes and skill shares by and for the community. Free school activities are always free, and everyone is welcome to join. They would love to have more instructors willing to share their knowledge and skills by teaching a free school class. They are also looking for locations to host a class. Upcoming class, Build a Feminist Toolkit, April 18th at 11 a.m. at the Growers Market. Contact via email or Instagram at freeschooleugene@gmail.com or on Instagram at Eugene Free School. That's FreeSkooleugene@gmail.com. Barefoot Defenders. BFD distributes food directly to where people are staying outside. They can use blankets, tents, propane tanks, tarps, and canned food. These can be delivered to 4446 Cascade Court. For questions or to join distribution, reach out on Facebook or Instagram at Barefoot Defenders. Lavender Guard. This group assembles and delivers food boxes to those most in need. It is a low-barrier way for people without fixed addresses or other limitations to bureaucratic processes to access food and have it brought to them. They need help sourcing more food supplies, dog and cat food, and/or period or menstruation products. Find them on Facebook or reach out via email, lavenderguardeugenespringfield@protonmail.com. Solidarity Garden, a guerrilla garden on the corner of 15th and Washington, near the rear gate to the fairgrounds. Food and flowers planted by neighbors available to all. Join a garden work party on Sunday, 10 to 12 a.m., or just come to harvest and say hi. Gardeners would also welcome a musician to play tunes while they work. Reach out by coming by. Food Not Bombs, a group that feeds people at the park blocks on Fridays starting at 4 p.m. Food Not Bombs is looking for financial donations to purchase food and survival supplies. Donate on Venmo at FNB Eugene or reach out via Instagram or email. Eugene Food Not Bombs at proton.me. To have your own project or support request featured in future issues, email editor@dissonanttimes.org. Our next story, Amber Fitz, Request for Continued Support by Dime Reed. Amber Fitz, longtime resident of Eugene, Oregon, and advocate for the unhoused, is being held in prison in Idaho. She was arrested in June of 2025 and is seeking support. Amber would love to receive letters and funds for commissary and legal fees. Amber is a wonderful friend and a dedicated advocate and a hilarious companion. She has also been essential to the work of serving and distributing food weekly to the unhoused. In the words of one of her friends and co-organizers, quote, "Together we gave food and supplies to the unhoused and housing insecure people in West Eugene every week. She has shown unshakable commitment to our community and our work. I look up to her, and while I have often struggled under the weight of our schedule and our responsibilities, even though she has been unhoused the entire time we've known one another, she works harder and faster and without complaint. She is a total inspiration to me and many people who live without a whole lot of kindness." Personal update. More than anything, Amber misses Eugene and her community, and she is bored. The cell block she is on does not have a functioning remote for the TV, and there is very little entertainment. She attends an optional class once per week and is otherwise mostly unoccupied. She is eager to return home and have the safety and stability to both continue her work in homeless advocacy and work through her own personal trauma amassed from years of living on the streets. Legal update. On October 27, 2025, Amber received a 7-month sentence. On May 22nd, she will appear before a judge to be evaluated and sentenced. They will determine if she can be released on parole, transferred to an Oregon prison, or remain in Idaho. Financial support. If you're able to help her out with commissary funds and legal fees, Venmo Dissonant Times at Dissonant Times and put Amber in the description. Letters. Write to Amber about what's going on in town. She loves stories, gossip, and news. If possible, include something entertaining such as a comics or a crossword, etc. Address mail to Amber Fitz, 163517, South Idaho Correctional Institute, P.O. Box 8509, Boise, Idaho 83707. That's Amber Fitz, AmberFitts, 163517, South Idaho Correctional Institute, P.O. Box 8509, Boise, Idaho 83707. Note, whenever highlighting an incarcerated person or publishing their work, Dissonant Times sends funds to their commissary or support system. And our last story, Love is a Challenge, What I've Learned in Community, by Strawberry Pancake Faye Nopales, Dissonant Times Disabled Love columnist. I believe in supportive community and want it, but community is one of the hardest things I've ever done. I'm going to come out and say that community is how people are supposed to live, and most mental illnesses are not diseases, but are actually the fruition of abuse and isolation. I've lived in 4 different communities over the past 10 years with my disabled spouse, Ming. This is what I've learned. Needs. When I first show up in a community, it's important to look around and understand a place. I like to observe. But if I observe for too long without asserting my needs, some people will treat me like I'm a non-person. There's a window of time when I need to start speaking up. Living in community, sharing a kitchen with brilliant creative cooks, I learned how to make marinades for tofu and tempeh. In the oven right now, I'm baking tofu direct from Eugene's local tofu factory. The marinade I stirred up is olive oil, sesame oil, quince jam that my spouse Ming and I made last year, lime juice, garlic, miso, tamari, and brown mustard. So divine. Living in community has helped me connect with other communities nearby. It's fascinating to compare how each handles food, race, power, gender, queerness, money, decision-making, germs and illness, sexual assault, and disability. I look at a place and ask, how did it get this way? I'd love a master's degree in intentional communities. My thesis would be, what we say we do versus what we actually do, words that hide behavior in community. Also, I love seeing all the gardens. We have such sprawling, lush, gorgeous gardens, and how Willamette Valley communities share resources and form alliances. I'd love more alliances. Roles. Tyrants are terrible, and I don't consider communities controlled by one or two people as actual communities. They're more like hobby farms or little kingdoms, but at least decisions get made. It's a different kind of terrible trying to make fair decisions as a non-hierarchical group. Anxious, intelligent people who want to consider all the information can get so muddled in options that months down the line, they're further from a decision than ever. Sometimes the final decision is made in a rash way that no one is satisfied by, just to end the process, which has become painful evidence of failure. Some common roles in community are energetic, positive youth, alcoholic artist, confident founder, den parent, kitchen witch, overly employed person who's never home, long-winded white guy, math person who controls the money, disabled activist, and generous baker. Every community has bullies, or at least entitled people who grab power for their own benefit. There's no community I've ever lived in without bullies. The solution is not to give up on community. It's to learn how to interact with bullies in a way that diffuses their harm. I try different strategies considering my own temperament, and it's difficult. A lifelong experiment. Disability and shame. Living in community, I've learned that many people who are disabled don't identify as disabled. They've been told all their lives, you're just a fuck-up, and believe that. Add substance abuse and possible jail time to that mix, and many people give up on their own worth. It's sad because you could use a reframe of, hey, you're not a fuck-up, you're just different and have different needs, which is okay. But by the time someone is an adult, they might not be in a place to consider their valid person. Others who are disabled don't identify because they associate disability with weakness. They think of blindness and mobility issues as real disabilities. They believe culture's lie of disabled people is a lesser than. They have no desire to identify with a group they consider unworthy. By not identifying as disabled, they miss out on resources that could improve their lives. They might even oppose people like me who identify as disabled, shaming us with, why are you focusing on the negative? They're hurting about their own struggle to appear abled. They work hard to pass as normal and think I should do the same. Wounds and conflict. Kind of how thin people who've starved themselves notice me loving myself and my fat body unconditionally and might hate me for that. The feeling is, how dare you love yourself when I've spent my whole life trying not to look like you? People get upset by an empowered worldview when they're invested in their own shame, or invested in their own supremacy, which is often shame turned on its head. It scares me how death transforms relationships. People who are complicated and difficult to support in community are easier to love once they die and don't need anything. It's heartbreaking to watch an outpouring of grief for someone when they die and know that person needed that love when they were alive. Living in community, we bring our wounds with us, including wounds from our families of origin. We replay old dramas with new people. conflict is hell. Few people are going to be fair, respectful, and considerate. It brings out the worst in us, but we have to try. Assault, noise, bathrooms, pets, children, and weed are hot topics for conflict. Love. Living in community, I've learned how to support, how support can flow in any direction. And young people can mentor older people, especially around queerness and transness. I'll always be grateful to the youth I lived with at Walnut Street Cooperative for smiling at me as they saw my mustache grow, excited for me as I explored trans identities. Celebrating winter holidays, making an ofrenda for Dia de los Muertos, and Passover Seder together, sharing special foods like quail eggs, amaranth, and pretty vegan cake decorated with rosemary flower petals. Kind little jokes we repeat over the years, early morning kitchen moments, and irreverent drawings on the refrigerator whiteboard. Harvesting flowers from the garden summer mornings and arranging them in jars for the dining room table. Backyard bonfires, delicious cookies, divorce ritual, a beautiful axe, a strange basement with rocks in the floor, and a seasonal creek. In community, I've lived facts that are stranger than fiction. As society further stratifies and safety nets shred, we need community in order to survive. We haven't been handed templates, but we can write our own. I'm bitter about the ways I've been hurt, but at least in community, we're trying. I prefer the struggle of togetherness to the hell of isolation. Love is a challenge, but it's worth the work. I'm grateful I've tried out new ways of being. Community has transformed me. I'm grateful to love people I never would have chosen to be close to. But here we find ourselves thrown together, washing dishes, doing life, changing the world. Strawberry Pancake Phainopoulos is an art witch anarchist who lives in community. Pleasure is their favorite way to experience God. Find Barry at listeningtothenoiseuntilitmakessense.com. ilikeyourstems.com, and on Instagram as xtrikesluts. That's at xtrikesluts. And our seventh story, The Court That Left No Record, by Jackson. Tell someone that a court in the United States of America conducted proceedings with no official record, no transcript, no documented findings, no preserved account of what the judge said or did, and watch their face. They squint. They ask you to repeat it. Some of them laugh, the nervous kind, the laugh that means, that can't be right. And then you explain it again, same words, and they still look at you like you're the one who's confused. You're not missing something. The court was. For as long as anyone can document, certainly for the duration of my time fighting the city of Eugene and its approach to the people it would rather not see, Eugene Municipal Court was what Oregon law calls a court of no record, no transcript, no preserved proceedings. If you wanted to appeal a decision, you didn't appeal the decision, you started over. A de novo review in front of the circuit court, which retries the case from scratch, as though whatever happened below never officially existed, which legally it didn't. Think about what that means, not in the abstract, in the specific. The specific is this. Eugene has a houseless population. Eugene also has a robust collection of ordinances designed to make houselessness as uncomfortable and legally precarious as possible. Camping restrictions, park use rules, trespass citations, curfew violations at public plazas, and the city designates as free speech zones with one hand, and then puts a bedtime on with the other. The people swept up under these ordinances cycle through Eugene Municipal Court constantly. They arrive without lawyers, without resources, often without stable footing in any sense of the word. They face a judge. The judge rules. And then, regardless of what was said, what arguments were raised, what rights were invoked and dismissed, the record of that proceeding simply does not exist. What the law does provide is a de novo retrial. Your case heard fresh by a circuit court judge, as though the proceeding below never occurred. That is a form of redress. It is not a review of what happened in the proceeding below. The judge's conduct, the rulings on your objections, the specific way the law was applied to you on that day, none of it is documented. None of it exists to appeal. You cannot challenge a judge's application of the law in your specific case if the law was applied in a room that left no official account of itself. The only available constitutional challenge was to the ordinance itself. Not to how it was being used against you in that room on that day in ways that may have had nothing to do with the law as written. That kind of accountability, specific, documented, judicial accountability for what a judge actually did not exist in Eugene Municipal Court. The no record status wasn't incidental to how power operated in that courtroom. It was how power operated in that courtroom. I accumulated over $10,000 in fines finding this out. I stood before that court more times than I care to remember. I stood before the Eugene City Council and asked explicitly for transparency at the municipal court. I worked with a Civil Liberties Defense Center to challenge the constitutionality of a curfew imposed at the Wayne Morris Free Speech Plaza, a name that deserves a long, slow read if the irony hasn't landed yet. The Oregon Supreme Court declined to hear the case. My conviction stood, and the court I had stood in kept no record of any of it. I am not telling you this for sympathy. I am telling you this because last week, February 24th, 2026, the Eugene City Council voted to change it. The city's stated reason was administrative efficiency. Making the municipal court a court of record, they said, will reduce a backlog of misdemeanor cases before the Lane County Circuit Court. Too many people were exercising their right to de novo appeal, and the bottleneck upstream was getting unmanageable. The solution? Give the municipal court an actual record so that appeals address what happened in the proceeding below rather than bypassing it entirely. That is a legitimate reason. It is also not the most important reason. The most important reason is that a court which keeps no record of its proceedings is, by definition, a court that cannot be held accountable for them. In a country where equal protection under the law is the foundational promise, not the exception, running a court on the theory that its proceedings leave no official trace is not a technicality. It is a structural decision about who deserves accountability and who does not. The people who cycled through Eugene Municipal Court on camping citations and trespass tickets and curfew violations were not wealthy defendants with constitutional lawyers on retainer. They were, in the main, the people the city had decided it could not afford to protect. The court kept no record. The city retained no obligation to answer for what happened there. Oregon created the mechanism to change that in 2007. Eugene never filed. One thing I want to be precise about. The February 24th vote does not undo what the court failed to preserve over the years it operated without a record. It does not restore the proceedings that evaporated. It does not reach back and give voice to the people who stood before a judge, made their arguments in good faith, and watched those arguments disappear into a room that left no official account of itself. That work, the people who showed up anyway, who fought the unconstitutional camping bans and the park suspensions and the curfews at the free speech plazas, who accumulated fines in five figures demanding that the rule of law apply to them as it applied to everyone else. That work happened without a record. It will not appear in any archive. The vote came 27 months after I died. I did not see it. The arguments I made in that court still do not exist on paper. What I know is that the court had a chance to preserve them and chose for its entire operational life not to. But the vote happened, and that matters. Not because it vindicates anything, because accountability is not vindication. But because the city has now acknowledged, in the plainest possible bureaucratic terms, that the people who appear before its court deserve a record of what happens to them there. That is a low bar. It is also a bar that Eugene Municipal Court was not clearing before last Tuesday. And Eugene is not the only place this is happening. Oregon has more than 200 incorporated cities. Of those, exactly 9 municipal courts have ever filed the declaration with the Oregon Supreme Court that makes them courts of record. 9. The state capital, Salem, is not among them. Bend is not among them. Across Oregon, the default condition of a municipal court is no transcript, no preserved findings, no official account of what happened to the person who stood before the judge and tried to argue their rights. The people cycling through those courts on camping citations and park exclusions and trespass tickets are standing in the same room I stood in, making the same arguments into the same absence. Eugene, until last Tuesday, was one of more than 230 Oregon cities where that absence was the rule. It is now, slowly, bureaucratically, for reasons of administrative efficiency the city found more compelling than the rights of defendants, becoming the exception. It is not enough. Written from the perspective of Eric Jackson, 1966 to 2023, with the words of Max Jackson.